any questions raised on, when was it? Whenever, yeah. Okay, over to you, Michael.
Thank you, Chair. There are two documents, maybe Alan, maybe I can just have a copy. Thank you. So the one is a PowerPoint presentation, which I will speak to today. The other is a set of responses that we've prepared, having taken notes in the discussion over the last few days. Obviously, this morning's discussion is not taken account of, but I won't go into the details that are in the document, but obviously members are free to browse through, and if there's any further information, I will cover it. But turning to the presentation, it's a pity we don't have the laptop because I'd made some small changes there. But anyway, here we are.
Shall we go ahead, please?
So starting off with growth forecasting, which we had quite a lot of discussion about after the presentation from the Parliamentary Budget Office. Just to indicate that National Treasury forecasts are on par with or better than those of private sector forecasts and the IMF. I've included two graphs there. On the left-hand side is a graph that appears at the end of the MTBPS in the fiscal risk statement, which shows the National Treasury forecasts and how they have evolved over a number of budgets and MTBPS documents. And you can see there the same point that the Parliamentary Budget Office was making is a point that we do also make in the MTBPS. And then on the right-hand side, you can see IMF forecasts of global growth that have been presented in the World Economic Outlook, which is the IMF's flagship economic forecast since 2012. And you can see that the IMF's own forecasts of global growth have similarly been revised down every single iteration of that flagship document. So I can say, you can interpret it in one of two ways. I suppose I'm saying it's not just us. It's common. And actually, I think it's a problem with economics in the sense that people have a strong desire for a sense of certainty about the future. And economists pander to that desire by providing forecasts. But the truth is that the future is highly uncertain. And we don't know what's going to unfold in the next 3 years. And this is a problem. So in general, economic models assume a return to equilibrium. So when you're faced with a global shock of the kind that you had in 2008-09, the assumption is, as is reflected in those IMF projections, that you've been hit by this shock that has knocked you off the path, but you will return to the same path. And they're not very good at accounting for the fact that the path itself may have changed quite significantly. And this is reflected in the IMF and reflected in National Treasury. Of course, for us, when we do our economic forecasts, we make assumptions. And if you turn to the next slide, those assumptions are critically important and the most important assumption that we make, probably, is the assumption about global economic growth. And in that table there, you can see that assumption, global growth, and the footnote says combined growth index of South Africa's top 15 trading partners, and the source of that assumption is the IMF World Economic Outlook. So we make an assumption about growth in our trading partners based on the IMF's projection. So if the IMF's projection is wrong, then indeed our own projection will be wrong. Another example I can point to from that table is we've then got commodity prices. Let's take the price of oil, which is listed there as Brent crude. It's the second line there. And you can see that the price of oil was $100 a barrel in 2014. It sank to $53 a barrel in 2015. Nobody anticipated this. And now we have an assumption that underpins our macroeconomic forecast that it will be $43 this year and rise moderately over the medium term. I don't know whether that will be the case. There could be, a third world war in the Middle East, or all kinds of factors, geopolitical or technological, that emerge that transform that outlook in the next few years. And that would have a major impact on our imports and a whole range of other. So that table there, by the way, is also in the technical annex to the MTBPS. So one way of accounting for this uncertainty is to look at risks. And as many have noted, this year for the first time we published a fiscal risk statement, where we tried to say, what if things don't turn out in line with our baseline forecast? And I think Mr. Mania asked in the Minister of Finance in the day after when we were presenting on the Thursday last week, that what is the probability associated with these forecasts? And we don't want to get into the probability, we're just saying our baseline forecast is the one we think is most probable, but these other scenarios can also happen. The one scenario A, and in the two graphs at the top, you get what is the growth picture underlining that scenario. Scenario A is quite extreme, but it has two parts. The first part is a big shock. So you see a contraction of growth in the first year. And then the second part is potential output growth is much lower over a very long period of time. Then if we say that, let's take that scenario, assume it's going to happen, and assume that we don't change any policies. In other words, we don't change our spending ceiling, we don't change our tax policy, we just say, let's model what is the impact on our revenue, and then what happens to our deficit, and from that we can determine what will happen to our debt. And you see in the graph below that the same dotted line shows then what would happen to the debt projection in that scenario. And you can see that in that scenario, our debt would continue rising significantly and would not stabilize over the medium term. The other scenarios are less extreme, but you see the impact there. So maybe now turning to what has been a big part of the debate and discussion in all of the presentations, I think, including this morning, is the kind of fiscal challenge we face over the medium term, and what is the appropriate role of fiscal policy. The MTBPS makes it clear that the challenge we face is to avoid a low-growth trap. Further deterioration in the economy could lead us there. In this scenario, and this is a scenario, weak GDP growth produces less tax revenue. We then have fiscal consolidation that is too aggressive, and this may bolster confidence of the private sector, but would further undermine the economy. And some of the issues that colleagues members were raising earlier in the week about, you know, won't these tax increases result in lower household consumption, and won't spending restraint and tax increases have a dampening effect on growth? And in the document in Chapter 3, we acknowledge that they would have a dampening effect on growth. But the problem is the opposite risk, which is reflected in the next bullet, that taking no action, in other words, not acting to offset the slippage on the deficit, could result in a ratings downgrade, capital flight, rapid exchange rate depreciation, and a spike in interest rates, resulting in even lower growth outcomes. So if I was Julius Malema, I might say we need to choose the better devil. Because on the one hand, you've got fiscal consolidation, which can have a dampening effect on growth. On the other hand, if you don't consolidate and you get the ratings downgrade, you could have an even worse dampening effect on growth. It seems to be a dilemma from which there's no escape. But there is an escape, and the escape is that to avoid this trap, government proposes a balanced consolidation, and this needs to be supported by action to rebuild confidence for investment. So I think in the next diagram, I'm illustrating in graphical terms what I've just explained, that you're in a lower growth scenario. This leads to less tax revenue. This leads to a wider budget deficit. And then you've got two choices. On the left-hand side, you can have more fiscal consolidation. What is the implication of that? Is rising taxes, falling taxpayer morality, because of course this is something we have to be careful about, that as taxes increase, people can take in South Africa we have very high levels of tax compliance compared to a country like, say, Brazil, where tax avoidance is the norm. So as taxes increase, you may actually end up collecting less taxes and you face that danger. In any case, you have falling spending, you have lower levels of public employment, you have increased pressure on social services, and because you have taken money out of demand, this can feed through into lower growth. And you may be further away from your objective than when you started. On the other hand, you could say, no, let's not consolidate the fiscus further. Let's borrow more. And then you will have rising government debt, a ratings downgrade, capital flight, interest rate hikes, it falls in the exchange rate, lower private investment because people lose confidence in the future of the economy, and again, lower growth. So this is a fiscal dilemma in a low growth, high debt environment. But it's important to remember, and this is what we're reflecting on the next page, which is also a graphic that appears in the MTBPS document. And I would commend to members the section in chapter 3, which deals with fiscal policy, which is on pages 24, which really explains what I'm explaining now. What the graphic shows is that, let's look at what South Africans owe in terms of three sectors: government, households, and corporates. And you can see there that government debt has increased quite markedly as a share of GDP over the last 5 or 10 years. But household debt has somewhat moderated. Households have been paying down their debts, the process of what economists call deleveraging. So households are in a slightly better position from a debt point of view than they were 10 years ago. Also, corporates have very low levels of debt, and at the same time, high levels of cash reserves. So the key way to avoid this dilemma, government is constrained by its balance sheet. And to some extent, households are still constrained by their balance sheets. So the key way to avoid this fiscal dilemma is to stimulate private investment, building on the very strong balance sheets of the corporate sector. But to do that, you need confidence in the economy, because ultimately, private investment, in the short term at least, is reflected by confidence. And this year, the most important economic statistic in the MTBPS is that capital formation is going to contract this year by 3%. So if you look at the economic forecast in the MTBPS, household consumption looks bad, government consumption is constrained, exports are not great, but the most damaging thing is that overall capital formation, which is investment, is contracting. And this is despite the fact that investment by government and parastatals is expanding. So you've got a massive contraction in private investment. That's really what we need to pay attention to. The fiscus has gone as far as it can in supporting growth, and now we need measures to restore or build confidence, at least in the short term. Confidence is not the path to long-term growth, but in the next year or two, restoring that confidence is going to be the most critical factor in restoring the momentum of growth. And in the MTBPS, we say government is creating conditions for higher confidence and investment by finalizing the regulatory framework for private sector participation in infrastructure projects, which was discussed in Cabinet earlier in the week, including initiatives in partnership of the private sector with state-owned companies, addressing legislative and regulatory uncertainties holding back investment in mining, agriculture, and key technology sectors. Remember that mining and agriculture are amongst the most employment-intensive sectors in the economy. And where there is uncertainty about the regulatory framework in those sectors, it's very difficult to encourage people to invest. Now, of course, we shouldn't only be thinking about growth. We should also be thinking about transformation and transformation in those sectors. But the challenge is that where there is uncertainty also about the transformation agenda and what it entails, for instance, in agriculture, uncertainty around how property rights are going to be structured into the future, whether restitution is going to be scaled back in time and such things. It's very difficult for people to invest in that context. So addressing those regulatory uncertainties would be important. Rationalizing closing or selling off public assets that are no longer relevant to government's development agenda would be an important thing. And concluding labor market reforms. And when we say labor, I mean, there's a whole discussion taking place in NEDLAC about the minimum wage, the strike balloting, and a bunch of other issues led by the deputy president. And we're hopeful that some certainty can be attained before the end of the year. And of course, government is working very closely with the private sector and other stakeholders to build this momentum of confidence. So the next slide I think I will skip because it just summarizes what we mean by measured fiscal consolidation. The slide 10 I included because I think there was a question about the structure of our debt. There is further information in the technical annex of the MTBPS about the structure of our debt. But this graph, I think, is important to bring to colleagues, to members' attention. Sorry, I'm used to speaking in government meetings. It's the maturity profile of the debt we have currently issued. So when we say we owe 2 trillion rand, these bars here add up to 2 trillion rand. It says, when do we have to pay back this debt? And the first thing you'll notice is that the debt we have today, we'll still be paying it back in 2050. Because some of the redemption, some of the debt is of such a long maturity that we will still be owing that money in 2050. The second thing is that over the last few years, meaning since 2008, on average, our redemptions, and redemptions is when we pay back debt, not when we pay the debt service cost, but when we pay the capital amount, our redemptions have been around 20 to 30 billion rand per annum. And when we redeem debt as a government, when I say pay it back, what it actually means is you borrow more in order to pay back, right? So you roll over the debt. Now, so in a year, we have to borrow two amounts. We have to borrow to finance the deficit of this year, which is roughly something like 150 billion. Then we also have to borrow to pay back the debt from previous deficits. So, and that up until now has been about 20, 30 billion a year. And if you add those two numbers together, you get what's called the gross borrowing requirement. But going forward from 2018 up until 2020, you have a massive increase in the redemption levels, because all of the debt that we've been accumulating over the last few years is now coming due for payment. So you have this increase in the gross borrowing requirement, which is an additional risk that we face because you have a rollover risk, and we're keen to address that. Moving on to questions about spending, cost containment, and spending on non-essential items. There's that graph on slide 11, which is also reproduced from chapter 3 of the MTBPS, which shows the real growth in spending on particular items. And that graph is an illustration of the numbers that are in the table on page 12. So I just want to, on slide 12, speak to the table, which also appears in the technical annex of the MTBPS. So, and I just want to, and I think the reason I'm going through this is the Parliamentary Budget Office also extracted some numbers from this table. Travel and subsistence, the first line. It means we were spending 9.7 billion on that in 2012. And last year, in 2015-16, we've spent also $9.7 billion on travel and subsistence across government. This means that if you take out the effects of inflation, there's been a real decrease in spending on travel and subsistence of 5.1%, which is the number in the last column. So if you had, so of course the cost of travel and subsistence has increased. The cost of airfares, the cost of hotel accommodation, all of those things have increased over the period. And if you were to have taken account of that increase and purchased the same number of air flights and hotel beds, you would have spent more. But we're not spending more. We kept it at the same. And that's a minus 5%. So it's a 5% reduction in the real value of that spending is what we're reporting there. Now, the very important point I want to make is that when we ask questions about consultants and such spending, there are issues in the way we classify. We have something called a standard chart of accounts, which sets out what do you call different spending items. And the classifications in that standard chart of accounts follow international best practice and sometimes can be very confusing. So, for example, often when people report on consultants, they include laboratory services. Because a laboratory, when a hospital sends a blood test to the National Health Laboratory Service, that is the purchase of an outsourced service for the hospital. So it's classified in accounting terms as consultants. But of course, when there's a complaint about government is spending too much on consultants, people are not generally referring to laboratory services. They're referring to what is called here consultants, which is like business advisory services. So you can see there in the third line, consultants, we've actually reduced our spending from 6.9 billion to 5.4 billion over this period in the past. Stationery and printing, also a real decline. There was a question raised about leases of buildings and why are we spending so much on leases? And it's addressed in the written response in your document to some extent. And it, of course, there are many things there, and it needs to be disaggregated. But there's a broader point to make, which is that government has a huge property portfolio, which is managed by the property management trading entity and Public Works. And if there are efficiencies that can be found in that portfolio, in other words, if we have buildings that we are not using, that we are paying leases on, that is a waste. And that portfolio needs to be rationalized, and those are the kind of things, efficiencies that needs to be engaged, including with the Department of Public Works, about our property portfolio, how effectively are we managing it. And it even goes, and there are different, obviously, this straddles national and provincial. You may have seen the Gauteng provincial government has recently done a review of its property holdings and is moving down a path of disposing of some of those properties. But it's not something that necessarily you would want to do on a central level. For the police, there are certain implications. For provincial governments, there would be different implications. So you would want to have a discussion with Public Works, but also across government. Okay, let me move on. I wanted to make a point, and this is one of the things I had changed in the one I was going to project, about economic services. It's true that economic services, as colleagues have, or members have articulated, have... do you have the... Yeah. Are not growing very rapidly. But there's a statistical problem there. And that is that the way we define economic services is a broad range of things, and it happens to include the Road Accident Fund. And the way we budget for the Road Accident Fund, or the financials submitted to us by the Road Accident Fund, because of their peculiar financial challenges, assume that revenue and expenditure does not increase over the next 3 years. So revenue remains constant at about 30 billion rand and expenditure remains constant at about 30 billion rand, because they assume no increase in the levy that is transferred to them, which may or may not be a correct assumption. But what it means is that that 30 billion rand of spending, which is classified as part of economic services, grows at zero. And in economic services, 30 billion rand is a lot. So it means that that very low growth rate of economic services is influenced by that factor. So when you look at DTI or some of the departments that are delivering economic services, I'm not saying their growth rate is rapid, but I think in the numbers in the document you see economic services growing only at 4%, whereas I think the DTI's budget grows something more like 6.5%. So I wanted to clarify that. Slide 13. Okay, so before I get there, let me just be more precise. So economic affairs grows at 5%, but if you look at the table on page 38 of the review, you will see that industrial development and trade, which is effectively the DTI, grows at 7.3%. Economic infrastructure and network regulation, which is departments like energy and telecommunications, grow at 6%. Science, technology, innovation, and the environment grow at 6.2%. But the one component, which is employment, labor affairs, and social security funds, which is the one I'm talking about, it includes the RAF, grows at only 2.3%. So I just wanted to bring that to your attention. The slide 13 is essentially responding to the excellent presentation made by the Rural Health Advocacy Project. And in our view, they raise very important points. What we need to understand about the constraints we're facing now is that, and it's maybe reflected for the health, for the education sector in slide 14. Maybe I'll start there and then come back. This shows, slide 14 is showing real spending per learner on basic education. So it means that in 2002, we spent 8,000 rand per learner in basic education in today's prices. So we've taken out the effect of inflation. Today we are spending almost 18,000 rand per learner in school. And the medium-term framework, which is the dotted parts, essentially sustain that spending. It doesn't increase it, but it doesn't diminish it. It sustains that spending over the next 3 years. Now, we would like to continue increasing that level of expenditure, but it's very difficult to increase that spending unless we have a return to economic growth. Also, it's worth noting that most of that increase in spending, because we're dealing with in education with something that is labor intensive, so we're dealing with spending on teacher salaries essentially. So most of that increase in spending per learner has meant increased spending on teachers' salaries, which has resulted from two factors. On the one hand, the number of teachers employed has massively increased over the last 10 years. On the other hand, the conditions of service of those teachers has massively improved, both through annual cost of living adjustments and through the occupation-specific dispensation that was introduced. So the question we need to be asking, or there are two questions that then arise. First, are we getting quality and performance out of that investment? And secondly, how do we now, having sustained this massive increase over a period of 10 years, how do we now navigate through a time of more limited resources, including in the education sector? Because if we were used to this escalation year after year, we're now in a position where we don't have escalation year after year. Now, the reason I wanted to go there first, it's the same in the health sector, that you saw a massive increase in employment in the sector between about 2000 and 2011, right? Huge additional employment of professionals, of doctors, of nurses, and there's a table in the written response that details by medical profession what the size of that expansion was. And also a huge, I think a 38% improvement, real improvement in the take-home pay, for example, of nurses as a result of the occupation-specific dispensation. Now we're reaching a point where we've reached the maximum and we're leveling off. And indeed, in some areas, there have been some small declines. But the decline that we've seen compared to the escalation over the last 10 years is very small. It's like we've escalated by 40,000 people. And now we've seen a decline of 2,000 or 3,000 people across the whole system entirely nationally. So going back to slide 13, the number of employees working in the health sector has increased significantly over the past decade from 234,000 to 390,000. So when I'm saying 40,000, I should have actually said 70,000, an increase in 70,000 between 2006 and 2016 over that 10-year period. This increase has largely been driven by increases in the number of health professionals rather than administrative positions. While the increase has leveled off in recent years, there was still a net increase of approximately 3,000 health professionals between 2015 and 2016. However, this does not mean that in particular areas, that when we now go into this different phase of not expansion, but a phase of leveling off, in particular, there may be pockets of vulnerability in the deep rural areas where not enough staff are being deployed. And there may be severe shortages in some areas. The submission highlights the need to identify and protect critical posts in such areas where access to healthcare is already level. In principle, as National Treasury, we support the contention that prioritization of posts is best done locally. And we will, because we have engaged and we do engage with them and the Department of Health, will continue to do so to try and manage through this period of lower growth in spending in a way that doesn't prejudice service delivery. The next slide, 15, I think maybe I will just skip. It just shows the increase in allocations to post-school education as a share of GDP, but I wanted to just take you through slide 16. Slide 16 is not National Treasury data. It comes from a study that was undertaken by the World Bank using local academics Ingrid Woolard at UCT a couple of years ago. And I'm just using the data, and I wouldn't stand by the data, but it just gives a good indication of the point I'm trying to make about a progressive fiscal system. So the gray part at the back shows market income. So that you could take GDP, the total income earned by different parts of the population. So, and I've divided the population into three buckets. The top 10%, the top wealthiest 10% of South Africans, the middle 50%, and the bottom 40%. So the bottom 40% are like your people living in rural areas below the poverty line, very poor. Your top 10% are the people in this room and those above us. The middle 50% is probably your average township resident. And within these buckets, there's a huge degree of variation, but I'm just illustrating a point. So the top 10% of South Africans, wealthiest, earn somewhere about 60% of the income in the economy goes to them. The middle 50% earn about 35% of national income. And the bottom 40% earn less than 2% of national income. You might as well say they earn nothing, right? Now, the blue bar shows what percent is paid in taxes. And here we're not talking about corporate tax. Corporate tax is excluded from this analysis because it's very difficult to know. Corporate tax isn't paid by corporates. That's the first thing to understand about it. It's not paid by businesses. It's paid by shareholders and workers. In other words, it's paid by capital and labor. And the division between capital and labor is not easy to know. But in general, the international consensus would be about 80% of corporate tax is paid by capital, shareholders, and 20% is paid by labor in the form of lower wages and higher unemployment. So, but capital, so corporate tax is not part of this. We're just talking here primarily about personal income tax and VAT and social security contributions and fuel levy and excise duties and such things. So the top 10% who earn about 60% of market income pay about 72% of taxes. The bottom 40% that earn about 2% of national income pay about 3% of national taxes. And the missing middle, or the middle 50%, which earn about 35% of market income, pay 26% of taxes. So you can, the progressive, leaving aside the bottom 40%, which is, you know, we're dealing with things that are not much different from zero there. But you can see that the wealthiest group of South Africans pay more in tax than they earn as a share of national income. Whereas the middle 50% pay less in tax than they earn as a share of income. The red bars then show you how is spending distributed, and that includes so education, health, social services and everything. And you can see that the vast bulk of spending, 48%, goes to the bottom 40%. Almost all the rest goes to the middle 50%. The top 10% get about 6% of spending, and I reckon almost all of that is through the university system. Because the university system is the one element of government spending that is channeled to benefit the wealthiest 10% of South Africans. So it's estimated that the university subsidy, FAS Fund and Burke at Stellenbosch estimates that anywhere between 60 and 80% of that subsidy is benefits the wealthiest 10% of South Africans, right? So the point I'm making, or my conclusion from this, is that what we need to ask is, as we increase taxes, let's have this in mind, that already the wealthiest are paying more than their share of income. I'm not saying therefore they shouldn't pay more, but the middle 50 is paying less than their share of income. And again, I'm not saying they must pay more, but how we think about the progressivity of the whole system is important, rather than looking at an individual tax instrument. Lastly, on slide 17, just some things for noting. Firstly, we've published a bunch of expenditure reviews. These don't necessarily represent the views of Treasury. They are reports that have been commissioned by Treasury working with Department of Planning, Monitoring and Evaluation. And they are published on the GTAC website at that address. Also, I would commend the Municipal Money site, which gives you budget information about municipalities. And then I quoted from a book on Wednesday when I was talking about the Swedish Social Democrats and how they approach the question of VAT. And there's the reference for the book that I quoted from. So thank you very much. I will conclude there.
Thank you, Michael. I think this was a very, very informative presentation. I would say in the future, because our colleagues sitting now in the Gouda chambers will also find this very useful in terms of what they are discussing now. And that's why we are serious, co-chair, that we review the Money Bills Act. All the members, there you have it. Questions? Clarity? I think it's straightforward.
Chair, I just wonder, should we ask what's the availability of members and so on before we decide? Because we've got, according to my watch, 40 minutes. I think it's enough. But then how many people got questions and so on? Personally, I'm out from about 12:20 till about 2:30, but I'm happy to come back at 2:30. So if members want to ask a lot of questions, they must be prepared to stay. Thank you. So I don't think this idea of answering questions and all is going to help the team putting it together. So, OK. Can you structure the meeting, please, since it's a primary, so we do that here.
Are you comfortable with that we are here for another 20 minutes?
40 minutes.
40? Honorable Tandy, can we hear you, please?
Chair, it's not a lot of questions. It's just one or two things.
Thanks, Chair. Just before I...
I made a mistake.
Get it into your head.
Honorable Tobias, ask your question.
Okay, that's fine. Okay. Mike, I wish Russell was here from Rural Health Advocacy Group, because then he will have seen that you have addressed his question in your response. I'm happy because we did indicate that we will deal with it. But the question, it's not a question as such, but I want to indicate, because I want it to be clear that the notion that the National Treasury has not paid attention to economic affairs in terms of putting more resources has been dealt with. So based on what you said, actually this sector gets more funding. And I heard the chair asking a follow-up on that. So maybe we should have a separate, and I'm not asking for more information, but to say a separate one liner that will demonstrate how the economic services has received its adequate slice, so that going forward to the debate, we will not find it. Because I don't want to say individual ministers might have concerns about how you have distributed in the economic cluster funding to their programs, if you get the point I'm trying to make. So that when we go to the debate, this matter has been dealt with once and for all. That's the point I wanted to make, Jay.
Thank you, Honorable Tobias. We are on the same page. That's the question that stays in my head, but you just raised. Honorable Manning.
Thank you, Chair. I've just got two brief questions, but before that, I'd just like to say that I completely agree with the Chairperson on his statement earlier that the Financial and Fiscal Commission should have a discrete slot and be provided with more time. I think that's absolutely correct. But we have received two very good presentations this morning, I think. My two questions, one relates to economic growth and the other to contingent liabilities. I completely accept National Treasury's presentation and view on its growth projections. The issue that arises is about Treasury's growth projection in the outer year. There's a narrative developing that Treasury's projection in the outer year is not credible. I wonder what your response to that would be. But I do accept your general point about forecasting the fact that ultimately everybody is wrong. It's a question of to what extent you are wrong. I accept that. But there is a narrative developing that National Treasury's growth forecast in the outer year is not credible. The second question is the whole question of contingent liabilities. Obviously, National Treasury provides Parliament with a full report on contingent liabilities every year during the main budget. But I think it would be useful if National Treasury could, for the during this budget period, I don't know what the committee's view on this would be, to provide us with an update on the current state of contingent liabilities, particularly before we debate the medium-term budget policy statement on the 1st of December.
You done?
Thanks, Chair. I just want to go on to slide 6, and of course it's preceded by the better devil's analogy which has been placed on the table. And I think, for me, quite frankly, that presents the biggest problem that we're faced with, to say that on both sides of the scale, there's a problem. And of course, you say to avoid the trap, government proposes a balanced consolidation, and I think we'd need to zoom into the dynamics of that proposed consolidation, but I just have one, probably could even be concluded to be a silly question. But on slide 12, you spoke about laboratories as being classified as consultants. But then on the same graph, under contractors, then you've got laboratory services. If you could just clarify me on that, to what extent it's in consultants on the one hand and how it becomes a standalone item in the same graph.
Thank you. Michael?
One is fools, I think alike, all three of us, saying the same thing. On this economic affairs thing, I found it quite complex what you said. You know, your explanation of what is meant by it and how it overlaps with other categories, that's the correct word. Outside this meeting, I would like some clarity on that. But anyway, I agree with both Tandy and the chair, co-chair, that we need to look at that carefully. Right? The other thing I wanted to say is that, I want to say this is a very good input. I've been reading, I would urge members to read the actual text, which I ended up with a copy while we were in that meeting. It's very good, Michael. I'm really, well, I think most of us here are very impressed with this. So thank you very much for that. It's also educational for people like me and maybe one or two others here, right? I find it, you know, you give me insights and information. It's an education thing, you know, like the sort of stuff you're doing in a certain waning political party some years ago, so you're not lost altogether, I'm glad to say. I also agree with you, you know, without overplay, with decisive action. I really do think it's not like spin. It's not like to win votes. I mean, who's listening to me in any case right now? Who cares what I say? I'm very marginal. I genuinely feel that notwithstanding the grim circumstances, to put it in its worst presentation, we can do much more to lift ourselves out of the difficulties we're in. And again, I see the minister's speech says it. I was looking last night at your MTBPS, the report again. There's a lot of it there. And it's not just optimistic spin. It can be done. I'm not convinced, for example, we can't save more, you know, in terms of, for example, travel and all that. You know, you basically gave the figures. Who was it? You gave it earlier. To say, well, in real terms, it hasn't increased. In fact, there's a minus 5.1% decline, right? Catering, entertainment, and venue. I mean, really. The sports fund of appropriations, is that right, Esther? But really, I mean, I don't know. You know, it's very difficult to know when you're finalizing the reports, Frank. What really, because there's no clear line, falls into the appropriations committee and what falls on our bench, as it were, right? But I mean, I don't see why the committee shouldn't say more can be done in that regard. Obviously, it's not you're very good from what I know of you, right? Very good in the way you manage those things. But, you know, other departments, I fear, are just not towing the line. So, and it's the president who must get it done, the leader of government business, I know. But I think we should say something. More can be done about that, certainly. Thank you very much. I really think it's very good.
In any case, I'm passing this on to my colleagues in the legislature in the Northern Cape this afternoon. Yes. You might get the invitation to come and lecture there for a day in the workshop. Coming back to this travel issue, looking at my province in Northern Cape, when I look for judicial directors or managers in Springbok, I find out they are in Kimberley. Next week when I phone, they are in Kimberley again. 804 kilometers, a day to get there, a day to attend whatever they have to attend, and a day to get back. You lose 2 days holding a steering wheel of a motor car. And you don't do a bloody minute of work. To look at the whole issue of video conferencing. And that thing we must drive. The MEC can sit in Kimberley and connect with the regions in my province, and those people can have the meeting. You don't have a car to drive, you don't have fuel to put into, you don't have traveling, accommodation, something to eat, blah, blah, blah. You can spend a hell of a lot of money, and that minus 5 can become minus 10. But we have to zoom into this, because it's been done in the U.S. It's happening there. It's happening in Mexico. Now, why can't we do it? All the technologies in South Africa. Yes, Michael.
Thank you. My colleague Ian, who yeah.
Sorry, you wanted to say something?
It's a follow-up question. You have explained the assumptions to the growth projections, but I'm looking at in terms of the revenue projections in 15-16, SARS has more or less collected as expected, slightly more. So in 15-16, growth forecasts were revised down, and we haven't created more jobs. So am I correct to say, if the forecasts were not revised down, in actual, in other words, if the economy grew as projected, SARS would have significantly collected more revenue, which brings me to the question of the relationship between growth forecasts and revenue forecasts, or else something must have happened in SARS. Either maybe more tax compliance or SARS has become more efficient, but I'm not sure what that is. I would like to find out exactly why is it, because if we 16-17 forecasts have already been revised downwards by 0.5 percentage points, in economic terms, that's a lot. So I'm just trying to understand the relationship between growth, economic growth forecasts, and revenue. Otherwise, they would seem like their SARS is conservative in its approach. Thank you.
The final one, fine.
Chair, there's a statement by the Fiscal and Financial Commission that sort of caused me to choke on my water. And that was the statement about the composition of SOE debt, that 68% of that debt is in foreign currency. I wonder if Treasury would be able to just provide us with a breakdown of SOE debt and the composition of that debt. Now, there's always a risk when I ask this kind of question, because it's entirely possible that National Treasury whip out the book and point to the page, and it becomes evident that I haven't read the document properly. But I do. Hopefully they won't do that. But I would. I wonder if we could get, in addition to an update on contingent liabilities, and a short report on the composition of SOE debt, assuming that it's not in the book. I think that would be useful for our deliberations and debate over the on the 1st of December. Thank you.
Thank you. Michael, you're on the floor.
Okay. I was going to say, and I hope there are no more questions, because they seem to be getting more and more difficult. I was going to say that my colleague here, Ian Stewart, will address that question, but he also pointed out to me that, reminded me that the numbers on slide 12 about the cost containment and the spending on various categories. Remember that those numbers, that minus 5%, is an average annual real growth rate. So it means each year on average since 2012, over 5 years, each year travel and subsistence has fallen by 5% in real terms. So it's quite a remarkable thing. And just to address the question, the words we use here in this table aren't exactly the words that are used in the accounting system. So that's why when you see somebody claiming that government spends 50 billion rand in consultants, it means they've taken an accounting term, and maybe in the accounting system it says business consultants or consultants, and then there are other things under it that include all of these other things. So here we haven't used strictly the accounting terms, just to be more kind of plain and for clarity. We've slightly departed from the official accounting terms in the Standard Chartered of Accounts. So usually the point I was making is that when you see people cite a number like 50 billion, 60 billion, it will include laboratory services, it will include contractors, and contractors include maintenance and repair of infrastructure contractors. And again, when you're building a road or building infrastructure, you employ engineering consultants. When you, indeed, some of the people who are employed as part of the Community Works Program, their salaries are classified under this contractors because they're not employees. So, and there are accounting conventions that require that in the accounting system, but it creates some confusion when you then try and translate that into what people are trying to hold government accountable for. That's really the point, is that here we're trying to give more transparency and make it clearer and plainer. But we can maybe, and I hope we can build on this as we go and report regularly on exactly this level of thing. The question about growth and revenue projections and SARs is very, it's an area where one must tread quite carefully. But there is quite a lot of discussion of this issue. Although it's somewhat technical, on page 27 of the MTBPS. Essentially what has happened is, in previous years, we've seen substantial downward revisions to growth, but revenue has held up in the face of those downward revisions to growth. So there have been some years where we, in February, projected growth of 3%, and by the end of the year growth was 1.5%, but yet we hit our revenue target. Indeed, last year you could say something like that happened. And this year, the downward revisions to growth aren't that huge, in fact, compared to previous years for the in-year. So in the budget we have said growth in the fiscal year would be 1.2%. We're now projecting growth in the fiscal year of only 1%. So it's not a huge downward reduction. And yet we are projecting significant shortfalls on the revenue side of 23 billion. So the question, a very good question, is what is the relationship between growth and revenue collection? And the technical term that defines that relationship is buoyancy. So For a 1% change in growth, what is the percentage change in revenue collection? And over the last 5 years, buoyancy has been very high. And in fact, I would point you to a graph which is in the fiscal risk statement that shows buoyancy over time. In the technical annex. It's in the fiscal risk statement. The graph, the numbers are, So buoyancy has been very high. For a 1% increase in growth, tax revenue has grown by 1.3%. And there's a concern, and we don't know what will happen in the future, but there's a concern that is reflected on page 27, where we discuss growth and revenue performance. And we talk about high revenue buoyancy under low growth conditions, what has sustained it. One of the factors has been, because if you think, it goes back to maybe the graph on slide 16, that, you know, when you talk about GDP growth, what this graph is showing you is that about 65% of that growth is income, growth in the income of the top 10% of the population. That's the implication. So while growth might be slowing, if the incomes of the top elite of the country, and I usually characterize it like this, people who shop in Woolworths, you know, if Woolworths is booming and Woolworths stock is performing well, it implies that, you know, the top 10% are performing well, and they pay, on average, 70% of taxes. When you look at personal income tax, and personal income tax has been a particular driver of buoyancy, they pay 90% of personal income tax. So if the wealthy are faring okay, even though that growth is slowing, you can have high buoyancy over time. So the question is,
Is that now, are they now also beginning to feel the effects of the economic slowdown? That's one of the questions. There are many questions, and it's very complex, is really, I suppose, the answer. Another issue that has affected us particularly this year has been, in the past few years, despite the depreciation of the exchange rate, the rand has been getting weaker, but imports have remained extremely strong. And we get a lot of taxation from imports, because we have VAT on imports and we have customs duties on imports. Now, for the first time, and so if the rand is weakening and the imports are remaining the same, immediately you get a tax boost, because the value of the imports in rand terms has increased, because the rand is lower. So now that imports have started to contract, and quite significantly in the current year, that buoyancy factor is no longer there. So there are a number of factors, complex factors, between the growth and the buoyancy, and I don't, and I would be very cautious about finding implications that involve SARS. SARS, we know, has performed very well over many years. I don't think, on the one hand, it's right to say that, you know, tax collection in a particular year may or not be above or below the target. It's not necessarily because SARS is good or bad. There might be those factors involved, but I'm saying there are big economic forces that explain these things beyond the performance of individuals in SARS.
It can be. It can also mean that the projections they made were either not correct. I'm not saying so.
So, and by the way, SARS is part of the structure that discusses the projections. We have something in Treasury called the Revenue Analysis Working Group, which meets about the in-year projection, and it includes SARS, the Reserve Bank, ourselves, that look at that. So, on the question of economic affairs and the growth rates, just to say, I was quoting from a table on page 38, where it breaks it down, and it's worth looking at that table, because the graph we generally show, the problem is it's at the highest level of aggregation. But if you look on page 38, we break it down a little bit, and it's not only economic affairs, even the kind of security cluster. You can see there are big differences there between the growth of police and the growth of defense. But when you aggregate them, you get the average. So there, on the, in that table, you see economic affairs, and under it, I was just quoting, and you see the last column, it shows the growth rates. So I wouldn't say that there is no issue that members have been raising about how do we shift spending from consumption to economic affairs, and can economic affairs grow faster, and such things. I'm not trying to argue that there's no issue there. There may well be an issue there. I'm just saying the aggregated number tends to exaggerate the issue a little bit because of this road accident fund factor. And you can see in there the growth rate of that cluster is very low, and it affects the aggregate number. Also, I would argue that, you know, we should be focusing on the impact rather than the amount of money we spend. So, and in economic affairs, one factor that is not included in the spending numbers is that they have massive subsidies through the revenue system. So you have massive tax incentives that are advanced to small business, to the automotive sector and others, that is not spending, but that should be really regarded as spending, because it's a subtraction from revenue. On the question of the outer year projections, just to go back to the graph on the first, on slide 2, on the first page, you will see there that the outer year projection may still be a little bit optimistic, but it has been falling. So if you go back to the first kind of dotted line, you will see that our outer year projection was for a 4% growth rate. But if you look at the last dotted, like kind of red dotted line, which is the current MTBPS forecast, we're only projecting growth rising to, what is it, 2.5 in our framework now, which you know, might still be a bit optimistic, but I don't think it lacks credibility. I think everybody would agree that even if growth has fallen, potential growth or trend growth has fallen significantly, growth that we're experiencing this year of 0.5% is well below what the country can achieve, and we would expect a recovery of growth over time. How strong that recovery will be, and especially in 3 years' time where we will be, is difficult to have a strong opinion about. So I don't think our outer year growth forecast, you could have said that 2 years ago, that they were overly optimistic, but I suppose we've learned our lesson since then, and we've adjusted downwards. Why? No, I think that's what we have now, is in this MTBPS, our growth projection for real GDP growth is actually 2.2% in 2019. That's our projection, which is not that, it's not, we're not blowing the lights out. Ian, on the contingent liabilities, and let me say that Ian also helped coordinate this document, so also thanks to him.
Right, Ian.
Thank you.
So on just to quickly go back to the question of the outer year forecast. I mean, we've looked a lot at the 3 year forecasting accuracy since 1997, which is when we first introduced the medium term expenditure framework. And our conclusion is, in fact, that we are fairly conservative or slightly pessimistic, typically in year or 1 year ahead, and then marginally optimistic in the outer year. But these are very small margins. Now, the issue is more around what's been going on in the past 4 years. And one of the issues is, I think, both in South Africa and globally, is that economists who do these forecasts are not coming to terms with the fact that global growth has slowed down significantly. And there is an optimism bias, I think, in the three-year forecasts, for example, that have been done by the IMF, World Bank, and many institutions. This is not a treasury problem. It's really a problem about economists struggling to understand what's going on in the structure of the global economy. And also to say that most of the comparatives we have are for the first and second 1 and 2 year ahead forecasts, and not for the outer year of the medium term expenditure framework. On the question of state-owned companies and the foreign debt exposure, I think it's a very important point, and it's something that we've been looking at in great detail as part of this fiscal risk statement, and we think it is very important, and I'm glad the FFC has pointed it out. I mean, the issue is that about 40% of state-owned company debt is in foreign currency, but there are two mechanisms through which we try to mitigate that risk. The first is that SOCs are required to come to Treasury and request whether they can increase their foreign borrowings over time, and that goes through something called the Fiscal Liabilities Committee, which has to look at whether or not SOCs can in fact afford to go into the foreign market on the strength of their balance sheet. And in addition to that, SOCs engage in foreign currency risk hedging, which effectively means that they pay the banks to take the risk for a significant depreciation of the rand, for example. And so there's a cost associated with it, but by hedging your foreign risk, you actually put the risk onto the balance sheets of the private sector, and specifically the banks. So we think it's something to keep an eye on, but there are systems in place to try and protect us from this risk.
And we will take back the proposal that we provide some kind of update on contingent liabilities back into our, because we don't deal directly with that in our division, but we'll take it back to the office and see what can be done.
Thank you, Team Treasury.
Can I ask, have you agreed to discuss the actuals in relation to the contingent liabilities of SOEs?
Honorable Tanzi, right, just speak into the mic that we hear better, and then Honorable Mania.
No, I'm just asking a simple question. I'm just asking whether have you agreed in principle that you will want to look at the contingent liabilities of SOEs in an aggregated manner, because I think this proposal will have to come to the committee and we can look at that. I'm talking to our chair, you know, and he's looking at this.
Yeah, not a problem. I mean, that is an issue that's in the public domain as well. I notice commentators have been raising that immediately after the MTPPS was presented. We'll look into that, yeah.
David?
Chair, thank you for the explanation about SOEs and the, or SOCs and the composition of the debt. I wonder if it would be possible, again, I mean, I wouldn't expect you to have the data immediately available, and on the same basis perhaps as the contingent liabilities, whether you would provide us with a breakdown per SOC or per SOE of their foreign exposure.
That was any marks? You fine?
No, I was just saying we'll have to go back to the assets and liabilities team and see whether that information is available.
Can I, you know why I was asking that question? Because we still await a report from the interministerial committee that will deal with whether there's a need to expand some of the state-owned enterprises, and they will also cover ground on the financial liabilities. And if we extract, because I wanted us to deal with this issue as a in a holistic manner, and once we move into that space now, when we're going to deal with that later, I don't know whether we will not be putting the cart before the horse, and at a later stage, because for strategic reasons, I thought there was a reason why we said, let that committee do its work, complete it, and bring in the report, and then we'll look at that. I don't know. I'm leaving it to you, Chair. You say it's in the public discourse, blah, blah, blah. I don't
know. Yeah, no, I mean, there's no problem. I think we agree that something should be done. How and in what form and when is something we can discuss in the committee and outside. It's not a problem. But, I mean, it's fine. We agree that a matter the committee should look at. About, I will check also with the minister where that process, Tandi, is referring to is, or maybe you can share that and so on. We can, those are things we can sort out outside this meeting. It's not a big deal.
Thank you, Team Treasury, for informing us better. Well, members, that brings us to the end of the meeting. I want to ask the co-chair to do the wrap-up because he's got certain ideas that he wants to provide.
No, not wrap-up. It's simple. Colleagues, we have to get the report done. The deadline is 5 p.m. Where's the team? We'll meet with you shortly after this meeting for 5 minutes or so. Now, the question is, you can't expect the researchers when they do their first draft to make recommendations that we ourselves as a committee haven't made. So, can you, in the few minutes left, we've got 6 minutes left, can you make some proposals on what you think they should put in their first draft? Tandi? Sorry? I can't hear you?
I just put my recommendation directed to her. I did not have it. Yeah, but I only had one chair. I didn't have 10.
So what must we put? Can I raise something, colleagues? You see, I looked at the last 2 years' reports, and, you know, to be quite frank, the reports are not up to standard, really. They do not actually address the issues. It's not the researchers' fault. It's our fault. Before the researchers get irritated with me, can I make it clear once again? I am not blaming the researchers. I am blaming us, starting with me as the chair. If you look at our reports, let me switch.
Basically, what are the
Colleagues, can we focus on the issues that we are required to do in the recommendations, which is the amended fiscal framework? So, what is our view about the amended fiscal framework? And two, what do we think of the fiscal framework that defines the MTEF? Now, on that matter, or on those two matters, can people propose concrete, precise, pithy, concise recommendations that the researchers can draft? Right. Start with you, Tandi.
Okay, no, I'm fine, Chair. Here's a recommendation, if it suffices. At least, Mike,
you
can correct it. Mike, yeah, maybe you'll correct it if it doesn't work. First, I will want us to consider the middle-income earners as part of the consideration for tax increases that needs to be made. Secondly, I will want us to make a recommendation that the Department of Public Works should address inefficiencies of the management of property portfolios.
Yeah.
So that's all I have for today, Chair. Please, I made another one. That's plus the other one, that's three. The one of yesterday, it makes them three.
Okay. So can I raise this, colleagues? So we've got three recommendations so far. We'll couch it in appropriate terms. After all these hours of sitting, that's all we're going to say. What else? After all these hours of engaging with them, we're in Parliament, we're supposed to instruct them almost on what to do. That's all we say. All right, fine. Three recommendations it is. It'll make your life very easy.
You see, the important thing, members, we must, in our report, refer to the revised fiscal framework. And that is the subject. The rest comes after that. On the 1st of what, December?
Yeah, but
still,
we just do one.
Yeah, Chair,
I've still got quite a bit of work to do on this, and I'll email you my recommendations.
Okay. When will you email them by?
I've got to work. I'll do them on the weekend and send them through on the weekend.
But 5 p.m.
I'll undertake to do them as soon as possible.
Yeah, okay. By 5 p.m. on Sunday, can you email to the secretaries, all members, whatever proposals you have got, and we will include as many of them as possible. Where we exclude what you got, that the chairs will decide. We'll say why. It's not appropriate. So we'll put it separately. But once you submit them, we can't just reject them as a chair. That's not our authority. We will say that we as chairs recommend we don't include this for now for this reason, and we include it later or something. Then the members can decide. So, you want to say something? Yeah?
Just in terms of my own sort of workflow, my intention is to traverse all the documents, right from the speech down through every submission to the final response. And on the basis of that, then I will send you recommendations, hopefully well before Sunday at 5 o'clock.
Yeah.
On the contingent liabilities, if Treasury are going to disclose the contingent liabilities, it would be useful if I had that before then, 5 o'clock on Sunday.
Right, just to say, like, what you do to get to where you have to is like not really something raises your whip and impress him, right? It's not something that we as a committee have a view on. What we want, though, is for agreement of a 5 p.m. deadline. And obviously, nothing stops a member from even making proposals after 5 p.m. on Sunday. Moreover, the final decision is made by the committee on Tuesday. So you can always insert stuff there.
I've got a problem here. I don't think we've agreed that the contingent liabilities should be presented before 5 at any of these days. I made a recommendation in terms of how we're going to approach that thing, and it seems as if we're agreeing on that. I don't think I share the same view with David on that one.
Yeah, no, I don't think there's a difference what you and David is saying. He said that if they are going to review, they will consult with their respective divisions, right? But that should be discussed. It's something we have no choice about as a portfolio committee on finance. We can't not do that. How we do it and in what form and so on is something we will negotiate. And it's fine for David to say that, and Treasury will consult. And if need be, I'll speak to the minister concerned, or you will. It's not a problem. Okay. So anything else on recommendations? The committee secretary, the staff at least, Chairperson Charles De Beer and myself would like to see you. For the rest, we're finished. finished exactly on time. I must congratulate you, Chairperson Chow, and we shall see you on Tuesday. Thank you very much.
Thank you, colleagues.